Ah, yes, that one's dedicated to all you ladies who listen to Coast AM. Well, we'll be back with William Henry, who has him chasing him all over the place whenever he goes to conferences. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. William, I want to get back to talking about your belief in the possibility of extraterrestrial life coming to this planet, especially in the Egyptian area, but also Atlantis as well. First of all, give me your take on who you believe the Atlanteans were, where they may have originated, and what happened to them.
I subscribe wholeheartedly to Plato's description of Atlantis, which was a civilization founded by the gods who came from the stars. Zeus, we're told in Plato's tale, dwelled at the center of the universe, which could well be the center of our Milky Way galaxy, or it could even be a far more distant center. Either way, these gods came to Earth, created a hybrid race of god-men that were imputed with a divine essence, according to Plato. Over time, this divine essence began to wane. This is why Zeus all of a sudden went ballistic, and we experienced the wrath of Zeus, hence the destruction of Atlantis. So I think based upon Plato's story that Atlantis was founded by star beings, extraterrestrials who came to this place to create life, to enable the growth of the human race.
And do you believe it was out there in the Atlantic? Edgar Cayce, of course, says in the Bimini area, Plato had a different view.
Well, right. But the key to me is this red granite, the use of megalithic red granite in these constructions. And you see evidence of the same construction in Egypt, both beside Abydos at the Osirian. You see it at the Valley Temple beside the Sphinx. You see it in Malta. You see it in South America. And it appears that Atlantis was, in fact, a global civilization. Where the exact center of Atlantis was located, that's still very much open to question.
Well, I got to tell you, the myth of Atlantis has been something that I have been fascinated with. I wish we could find exactly where that area is and just get some artifacts. You know, we've talked about the Bimini, the road. Mm-hmm. Edgar Cayce again says it's going to raise. Mm-hmm. I would love to find that area.
Well, let me share something with you that I think is very important that became clear as a bell to me, clear as crystal on this past trip. There is definitely a mental component to this whole Atlantis story. The story of Atlantis is what has been described as a meme, spelled M-E-M-E, which is like a catchphrase, a catch tune. It's a code word that enables access to other knowledge and even other dimensions of being. And it became absolutely apparent to me that to truly appreciate the heightened awareness of Egypt and even to connect with the true story of Atlantis, and these star beings, call them extraterrestrials, in order to appreciate them and achieve their heightened awareness, both sides of the brain must be used. And I wanted to offer, I shared on the site there in Atlantis, Egypt Plate 2, a phenomenal mandala that was painted by another guest on our trip. Her name's Anya Nadal. She creates these amazing paintings that are a form of visual meditation that combine colors and sacred geometry to put the brain in exactly the heightened state of awareness that I'm describing. And simply, if the listeners will go to the site and, as we're talking, if they have access to the internet, gaze at this mandala and see for themselves how their brain waves will begin to synchronize in a heightened state of awareness. And the reason I bring this up too, George, is because Anya describes that she has a being which she calls an Atlantean fairy in the center of this mandala. And to me, this is one doorway that will help any individual who isn't a meditator just to spend a few moments gazing at this and allow the imagery here to drive the brain into this heightened state of awareness. I really came to the awareness that this is a key to unlocking not only the mysteries of ancient Egypt, but also especially of Atlantis.
Were these messages in her book given to her by anybody, or were these just her writings of a researcher?
Well, they're paintings, and her book, it's called Holographic Mandala. And she presents, she's got half a dozen or more paintings in here that you actually put on 3D glasses. I'll send you a copy next week.
Okay, I'd like to see that.
Amazing experience, George. I mean, you put these 3D glasses on, and all of a sudden these shapes start moving before you, the colors begin to shift. And before you know it, you're in this heightened state of awareness. And that, again, is the true key to all of this, is being able to connect with this knowledge that is ever-present on our planet.
And do you believe those Atlanteans who fled the area made it to Egypt?
I believe that they did. That's why I call Egypt the shadow of Atlantis. And this means no disrespect whatsoever to the ancient Egyptian indigenous tradition. It's the way I tracked this story. And if you don't like the word Atlantis, that's okay, because I believe that most people understand Atlantis to be a meme or a catchphrase for an advanced civilization that existed deep in prehistory. And if you don't agree with that name, that's okay. But the fact of the matter is, George, that this place name, Atlantis, and another place name that goes along with it, Tula, appear over and over and over again throughout our planet, whether you're in Mexico, Mongolia, or any other continent, you're going to find this place name, and attached to it is the story of a devastating cataclysm that destroyed a previous civilization of which there were survivors who carried this name and place name throughout the planet.
You know, it's so amazing, William, with all their great technology, they could not stop this.
Well, I mean, that's where we get back to our conversation about Dr. Paul LaViolette and the tremendous power of the center of our Milky Way galaxy, and this notion that Atlantis was destroyed when a galactic superwave pile-drive the planet and wiped it out. I mean, we're talking about the effect of a boot kicking a marble, basically. I mean, it's just something you would have to have just astoundingly unimaginable technology in order to deflect something like that. But in fact, the ancient Egyptian myths and legends in the Edfu text, called the building text, do refer to these formless beings as utilizing relics, utilizing what I call power tools in an attempt to assuage the effects of whatever cataclysm it was that destroyed the first island civilization.
You know, the fact that some of them fled, they escaped. Some of them went to Central America, South America. Some of them went to Egypt. They were scattered all throughout the regions because there's too many similarities of buildings and markings and things like that. So they travel all over the place. The mindset that they had, though, the knowledge that they had, how were they able to teach that to, let's say, ancient Egyptians or the Mayans or whoever they did?
Well, they introduced very simple symbol systems, and that utilized symbols and even geometry in the temple constructions that they built as these teaching tools. In this way, they knew that a stone structure carries this knowledge within it, inherent within its architecture, and also within the experience that the soul engages in when it truly unfolds itself before one of these temples. They were masters at communicating knowledge at a very deep and spiritual level, not necessarily communicating this knowledge through books or papyruses or other tangible forms.
You know, William, do you have other people who support some of these views? Are you out there all by yourself?
What I'm doing is collecting a variety of thoughts that support this viewpoint. It's totally groundbreaking in many senses, but it's based upon years and years of research that has gone on by other researchers. I mean, I cited, for example, the oral tradition of ancient Egypt that Stephen Mailer is researching, and the story that I'm talking about now in terms of the Edfu text comes from another scholar, Dr. Yves Raymond. So basically, this is not something that I'm initiating myself. Rather, what I'm doing is putting the puzzle together in a slightly different way.
So were you satisfied with your trip? You think you came back with some information that you can use for the future?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, solid boots-on-the-ground research there at Abu Ghraib, photographic evidence of what we're talking about that is, again, on the coast site tonight. But again, most importantly, this understanding that it's a possibility for every individual to place themselves in quote-unquote resonance with this knowledge that is ever present. And it's not just in Egypt where we hear this story. Rennes-le-Château, they tell the same story there, that when Jesus and Mary Magdalene came to southern France, they deposited sacred knowledge in the landscape. This is a well-known and often cited capability that the ascended beings, the masters of the East, are capable of doing. They can take vast realms of knowledge, vast amounts of knowledge, and literally download it into a statue or a stone, so that those who are sensitive enough, who have developed their psychic faculties and their intuition, are capable of interacting on a vibrational level with that knowledge. It's sort of like a CD player, really, for them, George. I mean, they download the knowledge onto the CD, and if you have the internal mechanism, the internal apparatus to be able to access or play that CD, the knowledge of the universe is open to you.
Do you think it's entirely possible that the information about Atlantis and the technology from Atlantis has already been found, let's say, by governments who have just kept it quiet?
I'm totally convinced of that. One of my earliest books was called One Foot in Atlantis, The Secret Occult History of World War II, in which I chronicled Adolf Hitler and FDR's quest for these very secrets.
Was it a race?
Absolutely, without a doubt. World War II was a total occult war, which was a race between two conflicting and also competitive visions of the new Atlantis. Would it be Hitler's master race version of Atlantis, or would it be FDR's melting pot version of Atlantis, which is ultimately, I feel, what won out? You know, there are others that would argue with me that, hey, you know, really the Nazis and the Americans just got together and voila, we have our present set of circumstances, but that's a whole nother topic.
Yeah, well, that sure is. So, all right, so you go to Egypt, you come back. Tell me about the National Geographic work and what's going to happen with it.
Well, it was, again, a tremendous experience. It was really on-the-job training for me. The cameraman that was assigned, his name was Rich Confalone. Are you familiar with that History Channel show, Digging for the Truth?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah,
sure,
Josh Bernstein show, Digging for the Truth. Mm-hmm. Rich is Josh's cameraman.
Okay.
And has traveled all over the world with Josh. And so it was really a great experience for me to be able to work with a cameraman who directs Josh and to get a little insight into how that show works and all that Josh has to go through in order to put those shows together. And Rich, again, has gone to, you name it, Easter Island, Nazca, Egypt, India, and he, too, agreed he has never been to a stranger or even more magical place than Abu Ghraib.
What about the people there? Did you like them?
The people at Abu Ghraib or
in
Egypt? Yeah, absolutely. It's really pretty wild, George. I mean, the site is accessed through a very thick mango grove, and we're driving along as we're entering, and almost out of nowhere, like some invisible door opens, here comes this temple keeper, who just slips in front of us and say, let us know, hey, we're here. This is our job is to watch over and protect this site, and they gave us basically carte blanche there. The first time that I went 3 times, and But after a while, I don't know if Zayi, you know, was flying over and, you know, in his hawk self or whatever. But
he says, there's William Henry. Get him out of there.
Yeah, exactly. The alarm sounds and they're like, hey, it's time for you guys to leave, like, now. And so that kind of created a little bit of a situation for us. And then, as I mentioned, we went back again with the group, and I went back a third time with another local person. And, you know, you basically feel like you're in an episode of The Sopranos when you're in Egypt, because you have to carry a wad of cash and you just pay everybody off along the way.
Oh, that's true. That is. Now, how much do you have to pay to buy somebody off to get in here or get in there? $5, $10, $20?
Yeah, you know, usually I'm a little bit generous with my tips, so I would pay a little bit more than that, which isn't a considerable amount of money, but in Egypt it goes a long way. And so that I paid around $50 or so for my third trip, just as a tip. And but the thing is that we weren't there. I was there meditating for about 30 minutes or so, and all of a sudden the sheriff comes running up. This guy reminded me a lot of Saddam Hussein. And if not for having the local people with me, one of the gentlemen calls himself Mr. No Problem. He said, hey, I'm Mr. No Problem. Anything you want here in Abu Ghraib, you let me know. And he invited me back to come back and have a barbecue, spend the night, have a barbecue, listen to some Bedouin music, watch the stars and all that kind of thing, which I hope to take him up on. But it was pretty tense there for a minute when the sheriff comes racing up and he's got this real Saddam Hussein attitude, and it's like, whoa, 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 whoa! You know, this is not cool. You really need to be getting out of here.
Yeah, do you think Zahi sent them?
I have no idea. I mean, it's a possibility, but I mean, because they literally just came out of nowhere, and I had no idea how they even knew that we were there, because I essentially went in very early in the morning. We were being very quiet, and you go in and you meet the temple keepers, the temple guards, and you share, you know, a couple of laughs with them, and they let you go. And then all of a sudden, wow, you know, here comes thunder. And afterward, everything turned out fine, and it's a custom that you'll have a glass of tea with them, and it's just a way of thanking them for allowing you to come onto their temple site.
Did they ask you why you were there?
No. No, in fact, the gentleman who took me said for me not to even mention that I was there to meditate, or don't worry, mention the word pray, nothing like that. Just tell them you're there to take pictures. And so that was the reason I went there. But I went there just because it was probably the single most peaceful place I've ever been on the planet. I've never felt more at home than at this place, sitting on top of this pyramid by myself, trying to make the quote-unquote cosmic connection with whatever energy is still inherent within the place.
Did they ever talk about how they thought the pyramids were built, even there?
No. I mean, sort of, George, you really just don't want to hear it. About the 10th time they tell you that they built a ramp and hauled these blocks up this ramp, you're like, yeah, right, whatever. And so we actually started to challenge them and asking questions. A gentleman on the trip is a builder who is very familiar with moving large objects around, and was really asking the right questions of these guides about, hey, come on, tell us how this really happened.
I really would have loved to have had someone just to tell you the straight scoop.
I'm convinced they have the straight scoop too, George, and that's what's frustrating, is I feel deep within that they have already probably, quote-unquote, I use that expression a lot, but I think they've already looted the Hall of Records. I think they have.
I knew that. See, I always believed that too, a long time ago.
Yeah. Yeah, long since cleaned out. It's been carted off to who knows where, and maybe one day we'll have access to that. Not likely anytime soon.
Or they sold it to who knows where.
You hear that too? Absolutely.
Yeah. William, stay with us. We're going to open up Fast Blasts next. We'll take those questions for William Henry on Coast to Coast AM. Well, we'll open up the phone lines next hour for William Henry's magical mystery tour throughout Egypt. But when we come back, I think I'll go to Fast Blast. We'll take those questions next on Coast to Coast AM. William Kirk from Green Bay, Wisconsin, wants to know that besides the pyramids being made of stone or limestone, what are the similarities between the various pyramids that you have seen?
Oh, that's a very good question. The primary similarity that you have is this notion that they are all part of an interconnected grid that is capable of transmitting energy and possibly even acting sort of like a radio system to relay information. So from that standpoint, what we're looking at here is not individual pyramids, but rather an entire grid that is, as I noted earlier, a form of a musical system, in fact.
Do you share Christopher Dunn's views that the pyramids of Giza could be power plants?
Oh, absolutely, yeah, without a doubt. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, shrink yourself down to the size of a pea, crawl inside a Corvette engine, and you have a similar feeling to walking in the Grand Gallery, the ascending passage there into the pyramid and on into those chambers. I have the distinct intuition when you're there, even apart from Chris Dunn's incredible work, that we're dealing with an immensely, immensely powerful machine. And I certainly go along with this notion that this machine was capable of transmitting and receiving energies from the stars, from the sun, the moon, and then transmitting that energy throughout the planet.
Ryan from Texas wants to know if you think the folks who put together the Stargate shows had any inside knowledge or picked things up from you.
Well, I can't say for sure that they have. I do know other writers. I have a nice acquaintance. His name is David Titcher, who wrote a series for TNT called The Librarian. And in it, he references the language of the birds, and that's he told me is a tip-off to me. So I know that David has utilized some of my research, and I certainly appreciate that. I think his stuff is wonderful. And by the way, he's got a new Librarian series, new installment in that series coming out on TNT pretty soon. So I wouldn't be surprised if others are using it. I know other researchers certainly have used my material in the past, which is absolutely fine. I just would prefer that they cite me as a reference, if for no other reason than to provide an information trail for interested parties to be able to go to the source of the information and better evaluate what they're receiving.
What do you think the climate was like 10,000 years ago in that region?
Well, by all estimates, we were dealing with a paradisical world, a lush garden. When we're standing at Abu Ghraib, which is presently what appears to be a lunar or desert wasteland, we have to imagine that there was water everywhere, that we're sitting or standing in a lush garden, very tropical, very beautiful, very fruitful. And the picture that we get of the pyramid, which is certainly today in such a decrepit state, was that it was originally covered with these beautiful red granite casing stones. It probably had water running down the sides of it, and in every way, shape, and form is one of the most beautiful sights you can imagine, and would be a place that I would certainly like to return to.
Remind me, by the way, before you're off the air with me tonight, William, to get your take on the new gospel that has been discovered, the Gospel of Judas.
Mm-hmm.
Get your take on that a little bit later on.
Okay.
Do you have views on that?
I love it. I am ecstatic. This is just what the doctor ordered. It's time for the revelation of the true secrets that Jesus revealed to Judas according to this gospel, and also to Mary Magdalene. It is absolutely critical that this knowledge come forth, because it's going to be the knowledge that will enable us to defeat the darkness that is presently trying to envelop our planet. There is a war going on right now, and it's not just a war on terror. It's much, much bigger than that.
Is it an angelic war as well?
It's a war between the sons of light and the sons of darkness that has immense cosmic consequences. And it's time that each of us begin to stand up and really fully engage all of our spiritual capacities to flip this situation. We don't have to settle for maniacs with nuclear weapons trying to blow this planet to smithereens. It's time we ran them out of here, and those that are controlling them, and those that are controlling them, I'm convinced, are not on this planet.
Now, that's an interesting take. I do believe that they're being controlled. but I've never taken the planet, the extraterrestrial approach.
Well, yeah. When you go back to President Bush's inaugural speech in the year 2000, does the angel in the whirlwind still direct the storm? He asked that question three times in a 12-minute speech. The angel in the whirlwind are called the Watchers, and the Watchers are known as the Archons and the gray aliens. He's telling us straight up that these Archon Watchers control and direct this storm on Earth. And then in the 2004 Republican National Convention, he stood in the symbol of Atlantis and talked about liberty being a concept that comes from those from beyond the stars. What's he talking about? He's talking about stellar influences on this planet, and our president is a pawn to these stellar influences.
And you're a believer in symbols as well, aren't you?
Oh, totally. Symbols are everything in terms of communicating and transmitting ancient knowledge.
Justin wants to know from Los Angeles if you are familiar with The Gods of Eden by William Bramley.
Absolutely love that book. I met William Bramley in 1991 when that book came out. He's actually got a new book out now called Jesus Goes to Hollywood that I hope he gets some play on as well.
So you agree with that theory on Eden?
Absolutely. I mean, his primary premise is that the three major world religions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and also Buddhism, were set up by an extraterrestrial force in order to generate conflict on this planet. They've been very successful at it.
Peggy would like you to elaborate a little bit more about the Archons, is it? She's from Alaska.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, this is a subject that I first learned about, back 2002, 2003, when I was doing research on the Nag Hammadi Library. These are scrolls and texts that were preserved by the early Gnostics, and these were the actual books that the living Jesus and the disciples would have been working with as well. And in these texts, one in particular called The Hypostasis of the Archons, also subtitled The Reality of the Rulers, it spells out plainly that there is an extraterrestrial force, a predatory force called Archons, that are jealous of a divine essence that humanity possesses. We have it, they don't, they want ours, and they have set up this material world as a distraction in order to keep us in a fear, on a fear farm, so that they can harvest an energy from us.
That's not
my perspective. That's what this book says.
Izzy from Montclair, New Jersey, wants to know if, let's see here, how do you explain the slave ruins surrounding the pyramids if the pyramids were built by extraterrestrials or at least helped by them?
Well, the whole thing here is the word that I use is that the pyramids and these other monuments were made in the ancient world. And I intentionally use that word made because it refers to something that is manufactured or created. But made is also a police term for identified. So if a policeman makes your car, he didn't manufacture it, he identifies your car. And I believe that what happened is that these temples were made by the gods and later made or identified as sacred sites by various pharaohs and other regimes who then came in and assigned their own names to their construction and took credit for the creation of these monuments, although they probably had nothing whatsoever to do with them. So slave quarters around the pyramid, why not? Who's to say that those slave quarters were actually for the people that originally made the pyramid? Why couldn't they be condos for people that moved in later?
True. Ian from New York, what do you think of crystals? Do they work? Do they hold knowledge?
Well, I'm very fascinated by crystals. I have studied Mount Ida, Arkansas intensively, which is a source of the purest quartz crystal on the planet. I keep rocks around me. I pick up rocks everywhere I go. I don't consider myself necessarily a rock hound, but I do subscribe to this notion based upon Eastern tradition that the Tertons, the wise beings, the sages of the past had a capability of downloading knowledge into quartz crystal, just like we can download knowledge onto a CD. and retrieve that knowledge by placing themselves in harmonic resonance with those crystals.
Frederick from Ohio wants to know if there's any mathematical relationship to the position and location of the pyramids and the Sphinx.
Well, that I don't know. But what I could share with you, if you would like, is a brief meditation concerning the moon in the pyramid. Would you like that?
Yeah, now, and tell me about that. What does that mean?
Okay. Imagine drawing a pyramid or a triangle with the same base angle as the Great Pyramid, 51 degrees, 51 minutes. Now, in your imagination, draw a circle with its center and diameter the same as the base of the large triangle. And let this represent the circumference of the Earth. Next, in your imagination, draw a square that touches the outside of that Earth circle, and draw a second circle around the first one with its circumference equal to the perimeter of the square. This is what the Freemasons call squaring the circle. This new circle will pass exactly through the apex of the pyramid. And now here's the wow, George. A circle drawn with its center at the apex of the pyramid and its radius just long enough to touch the Earth's circle will have the circumference of the moon. The Earth-Moon system, and then the pyramid, is a hologram of this Earth-Moon system. Whoever built the pyramid, and it's ascribed in Egyptian tradition to the moon god Thoth, knew about our relationship with the moon. I believe that the moon is, in fact, the missing capstone to the pyramid.
The whole moon?
The whole moon. The pyramid, its geometry is pointing directly to the moon. Its designer was the moon god. And we find all of these incredible references to that are just very obscure to the Great Pyramid and the moon itself.
That's a good, interesting analogy, too. Candy wants to know if you believe that the Egyptians themselves might have been alien.
Well, we're all aliens when you think about it. And the question is whether or not you allow yourself to be part of the larger human race, or if you want to segregate yourself and say, I am an Egyptian. Well, that is, in my view, a limiting view. We have to open up to this idea. Even the Bible says that we were created by an extraterrestrial force of sorts. We're not indigenous to this planet. Our souls, according to the shamanic tradition, came from the center of our Milky Way galaxy or through the center of the galaxy, and we are temporarily inhabiting this temple of souls that is composed of the Earth, Moon, Sun system.
I find it fascinating, William, how the Catholic Church seems to be spending more and more time with extraterrestrial theories, devoting also several key members of the Vatican to investigate this or head it up.
Now we're talking, we're finally having a conversation. We're finally getting a little bit of understanding, a little bit of flexibility on these issues. And if this continues, hey, it won't be long before we no longer have these religious wars, that we're going to be achieving instead a galactic perspective. We're going to see ourselves as citizens, not just of this planet way out here on the Orion arm of our galaxy, but in fact, citizens of the whole galaxy. And when you look back at the Earth from the perspective of the center, all these meaningless differences that we jealously guard evaporate.
We're going to have Whitley on the program when one of his books becomes another movie on the alien grays.
Oh, the grays. Yeah, great.
It's going to be a great. Did anybody ever talk about that on your trips to Egypt in terms of what these beings might have looked like?
Oh, absolutely, because first of all, most of us were astute to the Nag Hammadi library and the presence of the archons, very inspired, especially lately by your conversation with John Lash. And in fact, I had interviewed him on Dreamland as well. But also, we have these strange depictions or descriptions of these formless beings that may even have been beings of light. And I say that because in Wally Budge's Egyptian Hieroglyphic Dictionary, which scholars really don't like that much anymore, but still, in that book, he says that one of the names of the Great Pyramid was Akut, Akut, which means light, glorious light, or shining one. But it's interesting, George, that Akut, according to Budge, also means beings of light, i.e., wise, instructed folk. And when you put that together, it formulates the question, did beings of light, wise, instructed folk, truly beam themselves to this planet long ago and then took human form? That's what the Edfu texts say, the building text at the Temple of Edfu. It clearly says, according to Dr. Yves Raymond, which again is subject to individual interpretation and controversy, but it still says that the original beings who came to this planet and founded civilization were light beings who took human form.
That is fascinating. It is fascinating how various civilizations will all talk about the same thing.
Yeah. Think of the movie Cocoon. That's, I think, the type of beings that we're describing here, beings of light that temporarily took human form. Very poignant story, and I think tripping on what may have been the actual truth in the ancient, ancient world.
And it's all energy, too, isn't it?
Exactly. And so are you and I.
William, what's new on your plate in terms of DVDs or books?
Well, I've got this my three-lecture series from Egypt, about 6 hours of talks, called Egypt, the Shadow of Atlantis. I'm very happy with these. I have some very demanding critics that travel with me, and I'm happy to say that they say, hey, you know, a couple of these are some of your best lectures. So I feel quite proud of that.
Don't you love those critics?
Oh, I do. I mean, it's they're
it's
quite blunt,
curve,
too,
it?
And it's like, okay, you know, you just drop the ego and take it as a hint that you can always improve, and that's what I'm constantly looking for, is ways to improve and ways to get more insight into these ancient mysteries.
And, of course, your website, williamhenry.net,
mm-hmm.
correct?
Yes.
Still stays
Thank
the
you.
Same.
Yes.
Very good. You get a lot of hits, don't you?
I do, and again, I'm grateful for each and every one of them and wish I could interact more than I can, but I do the best job I can.
And what's new with conferences coming up?
I got a string of them. I'm going to Naples, Florida, April 28th. Then I go to Kempton, Illinois for David Hatcher Childress's conference with Chris Dunn. I'm having my own conference here in Nashville, June 17th. I'm ecstatic, George. We've got the Quest for Immortality exhibit coming to the Frist Museum here in Nashville. It's the largest collection of Egyptian artifacts outside of Egypt. And so I put together a one-day conference on June 17th that'll include a tour of the Quest for Immortality exhibit, as well as the Parthenon and the Bicentennial Mall complex here in downtown Nashville that I call Stargate Park.
You think we'll ever find immortality, William?
I think we're one generation away from it. I think we are dead on, true blue, aimed at transforming the human body into a vehicle that will be capable of expanded life 100, 200 years, easy, easy, easy.
William, when we come back, let's get your take then on this new gospel, the Gospel of Judas, and get your views on it. I know a lot of people are upset about this gospel being found. They don't believe it, but that's part of the luxury. You don't have to believe it. We'll be back with William Henry, and next hour we'll open up the phone lines. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.